true, Dalinar said. But we do lack ones who are good at it. Noadon leaned over the railing. He stared at the fallen, an expression of deep grief and trouble on his face. It was so strange to see the man like this. He was so young. Dalinar had never imagined such insecurity, such torment in him. I know that feeling, Dalinar said softly. The uncertainty, the shame, the confusion. You can read me too well, old friend. I know these emotions because I've felt them. I never assumed that you would feel them too. Then I correct myself. Perhaps you don't know me well enough. Dalinar fell silent. So what do I do? Noadon asked. You're asking me? You're my advisor, aren't you? Well, I should like some advice. You can't give up your throne. And what should I do with it? Noadon turned and walked along the long balcony. It seemed to run around this entire level. Dalinar joined him, passing places where the stone was ripped, the railing broken away. I haven't faith in people any longer, old friend, Noadon said. Put two men together and they will find something to argue about. Gather them into groups and one group will find reason to oppress or attack another. Now this. How do I protect them? How do I stop this from happening again? You dictate a book, Dalinar said eagerly. A grand book, to give people hope. To explain your philosophy on leadership and how lives should be lived. A book. Me. Write a book? Why not? Because it's a fantastically stupid idea. Dalinar's jaw dropped. The world as we know it has quite nearly been destroyed, Noadon said. Barely a family exists that hasn't lost half its members. Our best men are corpses on that field, and we haven't food to last more than 2 or 3 months at best. And I'm to spend my time writing a book? Who would scribe it for me? All of my wordsmen were slaughtered when Yelignar broke into the Chancery. You're the only man of letters I know of who's still alive. A man of letters? This was an odd time. I could write it then. With one arm. Have you learned to write left-handed then? Dalinar looked down. He had both of his arms, though apparently the man Noadon saw was missing his right. No. We need to rebuild, Noadon said. I just wish there were a way to convince the kings, the ones still alive, not to seek advantage over one another. Noadon tapped the balcony. So this is my decision. Step down or do what is needed. This isn't a time for writing. It's a time for action. And then, unfortunately, a time for the sword. The sword, Dalinar thought. From you, Noadon? It wouldn't happen. This man would become a great philosopher. He would teach peace and reverence for others, and would not force men to do as he wished. He would guide them to acting with honor. Noadon turned to Dalinar. I apologize, Karm. I should not dismiss your suggestions right after asking for them. I'm on edge, as I imagine that we all are. At times it seems to me that to be human is to want that which we cannot have. For some, this is power. For me, it is peace. Noadon turned, walking back down the balcony. Though his pace was slow, his posture indicated that he wished to be alone. Dalinar let him go. He goes on to become one of the most influential writers Roshar has ever known, Dalinar said. There was silence, save for the calls of the people working below gathering the corpses. I know you're there, Dalinar said. Silence. What does he decide? Dalinar asked. Did he unite them, as he wanted? The voice that often spoke in his visions did not come. Dalinar received no answer to his questions. He sighed, turning to look out over the fields of dead. "You are right about one thing, at least, Noadon. To be human is to want that which we cannot have." The landscape darkened, the sun setting. That darkness enveloped him, and he closed his eyes. When he opened them, he was back in his rooms, standing with his hands on the back of a chair. He turned to Adolin and Renarin, who stood nearby, anxious, prepared to grab him if he got violent. "Well," Dalinar said, "that was meaningless. I learned nothing. Blast. I'm doing a poor job of..."
"Dalinar,"
Navani said curtly, still scribbling with a reed at her paper.
"The last thing you said before the vision ended, what was it?"
Dalinar frowned. "The last..."
"Yes,"
Navani said, urgent.
"The very last words you spoke."
"I was quoting the man I'd been speaking with. To be human is to want that which we cannot have."
"Why?"
She ignored him, writing furiously. Once done, she slid off the high-legged chair, hurrying to his bookshelf.
"Do you have a copy of..."
"Yes, I thought you might."
"These are Yasna's books, aren't they?"
"Yes," Dalinar said. "She wanted them cared for until she returned." Navani pulled a volume off the shelf.
"Corvana's Analectics."
She set the volume on the writing desk and leafed through the pages. Dalinar joined her, though of course he couldn't make sense of the page.
"What does it matter?"
"Here,"
Navani said. She looked up at Dalinar.
"When you go into these visions of yours, you know that you speak."
"Gibberish. Yes, my sons have told me."
"Anak Malakaf, Delmakin Haben Ya,"
Navani said.
"Sound familiar?"
Dalinar shook his head, baffled.
"It sounds a lot like what Father was saying,"
Renarin said, "when he was in the vision."
"Not a lot like Renarin,"
Navani said, looking smug.
"It's exactly the same phrase. That is the last thing you said before coming out of your trance. I wrote down everything, as best I could, that you babbled today."
"For what purpose?" Dalinar asked.
"Because," Navani said, "I thought it might be helpful." "And it was. The same phrase is in the Analectics. Almost exactly."
"What?"
Dalinar asked, incredulous.
"How?"
"It's a line from a song," Navani said. "A chant by the Vanriel, an order of artists who live on the slopes of the Silent Mount in Yakaved. Year after year, century after century, they've sung these same words. Songs they claim were written in the dawn chant by the heralds themselves. They have the words of those songs, written in an ancient script. But the meanings have been lost. They're just sounds now. Some scholars believe that the script and the songs themselves may indeed be in the dawn chant."
"And I," Dalinar said.
"You just spoke a line from one of them," Navani said. "Beyond that, if the phrase you just gave me is correct, you translated it. This could prove the Vanriel hypothesis. One sentence isn't much, but it could give us the key to translating the entire script. It has been itching at me for a while, listening to these visions. I thought the things you were saying had too much order to be gibberish."
She looked at Dalinar, smiling deeply.
"Dalinar, you might just have cracked one of the most perplexing and ancient mysteries of all time."
"Wait," Adolin said. "What are you saying?"
"What I'm saying, nephew," Navani said, looking directly at him, "is that we have your proof."
"But," Adolin said, "I mean, he could have heard that one phrase."
"And extrapolated an entire language from it?"
Navani said, holding up a sheet full of writings.
"This is not gibberish, but it's no language that people now speak. I suspect it is what it seems. The dawn chant, So unless you can think of another way your father learned to speak a dead language, Adolin, the visions are most certainly real.
The room fell silent. Navani herself looked stunned by what she had said. She shook it off quickly.
Now, Dalinar, she said, I want you to describe this vision as accurately as possible. I need the exact words you spoke, if you can recall them. Every bit we gather will help my scholars sort through this.
Right for wrong. In the storm I awaken, falling, spinning, grieving. Dated Kakanev, 1173. 13 seconds pre-death. Subject was a city guardsman.
How can you be so sure it was him, Dalinar?
Navani asked softly. Dalinar shook his head.
I just am. That was Noadon.
It had been several hours since the end of the vision. Navani had left her writing table to sit in a more comfortable chair near Dalinar. Renarin sat across from him, accompanying them for propriety's sake. Adolin had left to get the high storm damage report. The lad had seemed very disturbed by the discovery that the visions were real.
But the man you saw never spoke his name, Navani said.
It was him, Navani.
Dalinar stared toward the wall over Renarin's head, looking at the smooth brown soul-cast rock.
There was an aura of command about him, the weight of great responsibilities, a regality.
It could have been some other king, she said. After all, he discarded your suggestion that he write a book.
It just wasn't the time for him to write it yet. So much death. He was cast down by some great loss. Stormfather, 9 out of 10 people dead in war? Can you imagine such a thing?
The desolations, Navani said. Unite the people. The true desolation comes.
Do you know of any references to the desolations? Dalinar asked. Not the tales Ardens tell. Historical references.
Navani held a cup of warmed violet wine in her hand, beads of condensation on the rim of the glass.
Yes, but I am the wrong one to ask. Yasna is the historian.
I think I saw the aftermath of one. I may have seen corpses of Voidbringers. Could that give us more proof?
Nothing nearly as good as the linguistics.
Navani took a sip of her wine.
The desolations are matters of ancient lore. It could be argued that you imagined what you expected to see. But those words, if we can translate them, nobody will be able to dispute that you are seeing something real.
Her writing board lay on the low table between them, reed and ink set carefully across the paper.
You intend to tell others? Dalinar asked. Of my visions?
How else will we explain what is happening to you?
Dalinar hesitated.
How could he explain? On one hand, it was relieving to know that he was not mad. But what if some force were trying to mislead him with these visions, using images of Noadon and the Radiance because he would find them trustworthy?
The Knights Radiant fell, Dalinar reminded himself. They abandoned us.
Some of the other orders may have turned against us, as the legends say.
There was an unsettling edge to all of that. He had another stone in rebuilding the foundation of who he was, but the most important point still remained undecided. Did he trust his visions or not? He couldn't go back to believing them unquestioningly, not now that Adolin's challenges had raised real worries in his head. Until he knew their source, he felt he shouldn't spread knowledge of them.
Dalinar, Navani said, leaning forward. The war camps speak of your episodes. Even the wives of your officers are uncomfortable. They think you fear the storms, or that you have some disease of the mind. This will vindicate you.
How? By making me into some kind of mystic?
Many will think that the breeze of these visions blows too close to prophecy.
You see the past, Father, Renarin said. That is not forbidden. And if the Almighty sends them, then how could men question?
Adolin and I both spoke with Ardens, Dalinar replied. They said it was very unlikely that this would come from the Almighty. If we do decide the visions are to be trusted, many will disagree with me.
Navani settled back, sipping her wine, safe hand lying across her lap.
Dalinar, your sons told me that you once sought the old magic. Why? What did you ask of the Night Watcher? And what curse did she give you in return?
I told them that my shame is my own, Dalinar said, and I will not share it.
The room fell silent. The flurries of rain following the high storm had ceased falling on the roof.
It might be important, Navani finally said.
It was long ago, long before the visions began. I don't think it's related.
But it could be.
Yes, he admitted. Would that day never stop haunting him? Was not losing all memory of his wife enough? What did Renarin think? Would he condemn his father for such an egregious sin?
Dalinar forced himself to look up and meet his son's bespectacled eyes. Curiously, Renarin didn't seem bothered, just thoughtful.
I'm sorry you had to discover my shame, Dalinar said, looking to Navani.
She waved indifferently.
Soliciting the old magic is offensive to the devotaries, but their punishments for the act are never severe. I assume that you didn't have to do much to be cleansed.
The Ardents asked for spheres to give the poor, Dalinar said. And I had to commission a series of prayers. None of that removed the effects or my sense of guilt.
I think you'd be surprised at how many devout light eyes turn to the old magic at one point in their lives or another. The ones who can make their way to the valley, at least. But I do wonder if this is related.
Aunt, Renarin said, turning to her, I have recently asked for a number of readings about the old magic. I agree with his assessment. This does not feel like the work of the Night Watcher. She gives curses in exchange for granting small desires. Always one curse and one desire. Father, I assume you know what both of those things are?
Yes, he said. I know exactly what my curse was, and it does not relate to this.
Then it is unlikely that the old magic is to blame.
Yes, Dalinar said. But your aunt is right to question. The truth is, we don't have any proof that this came from the Almighty, either. Something wants me to know of the desolations and the Night's Radiant. Perhaps we should start asking ourselves why that is.
What were the desolations, aunt? Renarin asked. The Ardents talk of the Voidbringers, of mankind and the Radiance, and of fighting. But what were they really? Do we know anything specific? There are folklorists among your father's clerks who would serve you better in this matter.
Perhaps, Dalinar nodded, but I'm not sure which of them I can trust.
Navani paused.
Fair enough. Well, from what I understand, there are no primary accounts remaining. This was long, long ago. I do recall that the myth of Parasaphi and Nadris mentions the desolations.
Parasaphi, Renarin said. She's the one who searched out the seed stones.
Yes,
Navani replied.
In order to repopulate her fallen people, she climbed the peaks of Dera. The myth changes, listing different modern mountain ranges as the true peaks of Dera, to find stones touched by the heralds themselves. She brought them to Nadris on his deathbed and harvested his seed to bring life to the stones. They hatched forth 10 children, which she used to found a new nation. Marna, I believe it was called.
Origin of the Makabaki, Renarin said. Mother told me that story when I was a child.
Dalinar shook his head. Born from rocks? The old stories rarely made much sense to him,
although the Devoteries had canonized many of them.
The story mentions the desolations at the beginning, Navani said, giving them credit for having wiped out Parasafi's people.
But what were they?
Wars.
Navani took a sip of wine.
The Voidbringers came again and again, trying to force mankind off Roshar and into damnation, just as they once forced mankind, and the Heralds, out of the Tranquiline Halls.
When were the Knights Radiant founded? Dalinar asked. Navani shrugged.
I don't know. Perhaps they were some military group from a specific kingdom, or perhaps they were originally a mercenary band. That would make it easy to see how they could eventually become tyrants.
My visions don't imply that they were tyrants, he said. Perhaps that is the true purpose of the visions. To make me believe lies about the Radiance. Making me trust them. Perhaps trying to lead me to mimic their downfall and betrayal.
I don't know,
Navani said, sounding skeptical.
I don't think you've seen anything untrue about the Radiance. The legends tend to agree that the Radiance weren't always so bad. As much as the legends agree on anything, at least.
Dalinar stood and took her nearly empty cup, then walked over to the serving table and refilled it. Discovering that he was not mad should have helped clear things up, but instead left him more disturbed. What if the Voidbringers were behind the visions? Some stories he heard said that they could possess the bodies of men and make them do evil. Or, if they were from the Almighty, what was their purpose?
I need to think on all of this, he said. It's been a long day. Please, if I could be left to my own thoughts now.
Renarin rose and bowed his head in respect before heading to the door. Navani rose more slowly, sleek dress rustling as she set her cup on the table, then walked over to fetch her pain-drinking Fabriel. Renarin left, and Dalinar walked to the doorway, waiting as Navani approached. He didn't intend to let her trap him alone again. He looked out the doorway. His soldiers were there, and he could see them. Good.
Aren't you pleased at all?
Navani asked, lingering beside the doorway near him, one hand on the frame.
Pleased? You aren't going mad.
And we don't know if I'm being manipulated or not, he said. In a way, we have more questions now than we had before.
The visions are a blessing, Navani said, laying her free hand on his arm. I feel it, Dalinar. Don't you see how wonderful this is?
Dalinar met her eyes, light violet, beautiful. She was so thoughtful, so clever. How he wished he could trust her completely. She has shown me nothing but honor, he thought, never speaking a word to anyone else of my intention to abdicate. She hasn't so much as tried to use my visions against me. He felt ashamed that he'd once worried that she might. She was a wonderful woman, Navani Kolin. A wonderful, amazing, dangerous woman. I see more worries, he said, and more danger.
But Dalinar, you're having experiences scholars, historians, and folklorists could only dream about. I envy you, although you claim to have seen no Fabriels of note.
The ancients don't have Fabriels, Navani. I'm certain of it.
And that changes everything we thought we understood about them.
I suppose.
Stone falls, Dalinar, she said, sighing. Does nothing bring you to passion any longer?
Dalinar took a deep breath. Too many things, Navani. My insides feel like a mass of eels, emotions squirming over one another. The truth of these visions is unsettling.
It's exciting, she corrected.
Did you mean what you said earlier? About trusting me?
I said that.
You said you didn't trust your clerks, and you asked me to record the visions.
There's an implication in that.
Her hand was still on his arm. She reached out with her safe hand and closed the door to the hallway. He almost stopped her, but he hesitated.
Why? The door clicked closed. They were alone. And she was so beautiful. Those clever, excitable eyes, alight with passion.
Navani, Dalinar said, forcing down his desire. You're doing it again.
Why did he let her?
Yes, I am, she said. I'm a stubborn woman, Dalinar.
There didn't seem to be any playfulness in her tone.
This is not proper. My brother...
He reached for the door to open it again.
Your brother,
Navani spat, expression flashing with anger.
Why must everyone always focus on him? Everyone always worries so much about the man who died. He's not here, Dalinar. He's gone. I miss him, but not half as much as you do, it appears.
I honor his memory, Dalinar said stiffly, hesitating, hand on the door's latch.
That's fine. I'm happy you do. But it's been 6 years, and all anyone can see me as is the wife of a dead man. The other women, they humor me with idle gossip, but they won't let me into their political circles. They think I'm a relic. You wanted to know why I came back so quickly?
I returned, she said, because I have no home. I'm expected to sit out of important events because my husband is dead. Lounge around, pampered but ignored. I make them uncomfortable. The queen, the other women at court.
I'm sorry, Dalinar said. But I don't. She raised her free hand, tapping him on the chest.
I won't take it from you, Dalinar. We were friends before I even met Gavilar. You still know me as me, not some shadow of a dynasty that crumbled years ago. Don't you?
She looked at him, pleading.
Blood of my fathers, Dalinar thought with shock. She's crying. Two small tears. He had rarely seen her so sincere. And so he kissed her. It was a mistake. He knew it was. He grabbed her anyway, pulling her into a rough, tight embrace and pressing his mouth to hers, unable to contain himself. She melted against him. He tasted the salt of her tears as they ran down to her lips and met his. It lasted long, too long, wonderfully long. His mind screamed at him like a prisoner chained in a cell and forced to watch something horrible. But a part of him had wanted this for decades. Decades spent watching his brother court, marry, and then hold the only woman that the young Dalinar had ever wanted. He'd told himself he would never allow this. He had denied himself feelings for Navani the moment Gavilar had won her hand. Dalinar had stepped aside. But the taste of her, the smell of her, the warmth of her pressed against him, was too sweet. Like a blossoming perfume, it washed away the guilt. For a moment, that touch banished everything. He couldn't remember his fear at the visions, his worry about Satius, his shame at past mistakes. He could only think of her, beautiful, insightful, delicate yet strong at once. He clung to her, something he could hold on to as the rest of the world churned around him. Eventually, he broke the kiss. She looked up at him, dazed. Passion spren, like tiny flakes of crystalline snow, floated down in the air around them. Guilt flooded him again. He tried gently to push her away, but she clung to him, holding on tight. Navani, he said.
Hush.
She pressed her head against his chest.
We can't.
Hush,
she said more insistently. He sighed, but let himself hold her.
Something is going wrong in this world, Dalinar,
Navani said softly.
The king of Yakaved was assassinated. I heard it just today. He was killed by a Shin shardbearer in white clothing.
Stormfather, Dalinar said.
Something's going on, she said. Something bigger than our war here. Something bigger than Gavilar. Have you heard of the twisted things men say when they die? Most ignore it, but surgeons are talking.
and storm wardens whisper that the high storms are growing more powerful.
I have heard, he said, finding it difficult to get the words out, intoxicated by her as he was.
My daughter seeks something, Navani said. She frightens me sometimes. She's so intense. I honestly believe she's the most intelligent person I've ever known. And the things she searches for. Dalinashi believes that something very dangerous is near.
The sun approaches the horizon. The everstorm comes. The true desolation. The night of sorrows.
I need you, Navani said. I've known it for years, though I feared it would destroy you with guilt, so I fled. But I couldn't stay away. Not with the way they treat me. Not with what is happening to the world. I'm terrified, Dalinar, and I need you. Gavala was not the man everyone thought him to be. I was fond of him, but he...
Please, Dalinar said. Don't speak ill of him.
Very well.
Blood of my fathers.
He couldn't get her scent out of his head. He felt paralyzed, holding to her like a man clinging to a stone in the storm winds. She looked up at him.
Well, let it be said, then, that I was fond of Gavilar. But I'm more fond of you. And I'm tired of waiting.
He closed his eyes.
How can this work?
We'll find a way.
We'll be denounced.
The war camps already ignore me, Navani said, and they spread rumors and lies about you. What more can they do to us?
They'll find something. As of yet, the Devateres do not condemn me.
Gavilar is dead,
Navani said, resting her head back against his chest.
I was never unfaithful while he lived, though the Stormfather knows I had ample reason. The Devateres can say what they wish, but the arguments do not forbid our union. Tradition is not the same as doctrine, and I will not hold myself back for fear of offending.
Dalinar took a deep breath, then forced himself to open his arms and pull back.
If you had hoped to soothe my worries for the day, then this didn't help.
She folded her arms. He could still feel where her safe hand had touched him on the back. A tender touch, reserved for a family member.
I'm not here to soothe you, Dalinar. Quite the opposite.
Please. I do need time to think.
I won't let you put me away. I won't ignore that this happened. I won't...
Navani... He gently cut her off. I will not abandon you. I promise.
She eyed him, then a wry smile crept onto her face.
Very well. But you began something today.
I began it,
he asked, amused, elated, confused, worried, and ashamed at the same time.
The kiss was yours, Dalinar,
she said idly, pulling open the door and entering his antechamber.
You seduced me to it.
What? Seduced?
She glanced back at him.
Dalinar, I've never been more open and honest in my life.
I know, Dalinar said, smiling. That was the seductive part.
He closed the door softly, then let out a sigh.
Blood of my fathers, he thought. Why can't these things ever be simple?
And yet, in direct contrast with his thoughts, he felt as if the entire world had somehow become more right for having gone wrong.
Sixty-two. Three glyphs.
The darkness becomes a palace. Let it rule! Let it rule!
Kakava, 1173. 22 seconds pre-death. A dark-eyed Selai man of unknown profession.
You think one of those will save us? Moash asked, scowling as he looked at the prayer tied about Kaladin's upper right arm.
Kaladin glanced to the side.
He stood at parade rest as Sadius's soldiers crossed their bridge. The chilly spring air felt good, now that he'd started working. The sky was bright, cloudless, and the storm wardens promised that no high storm was near. The prayer tied in his arms was simple. Three glyphs. Wind, protection, beloved. A prayer to Ysereza, the Storm Father, to protect loved ones and friends. It was the straightforward type his mother had preferred. For all her subtlety and wryness, whenever she'd knitted or written a prayer, it had been simple and heartfelt. Wearing it reminded him of her.
"I can't believe you paid good money for that," Moash said. "If there are heralds watching, they don't pay any mind to bridgemen."
"I've been feeling nostalgic lately, I guess." The prayer was probably meaningless, but he'd had reason to start thinking more about religion lately. The life of a slave made it difficult for many to believe that anyone, or anything, was watching. Yet many bridgemen had grown more religious during their captivity. Two groups, opposite reactions. Did that mean some were stupid and others were callous? Or something else entirely?
"They're going to see us dead, you know," Dre said from behind. "This is it."
The bridgemen were exhausted. Kaladin and his team had been forced to work the chasms all night. Ashal had put strict requirements on them, demanding an increased amount of salvage. In order to meet the quota, they'd foregone training to scavenge. And then today, they'd been awakened for a morning chasm assault after only 3 hours of sleep. They were drooping as they stood in line, and they hadn't even reached the contested plateau yet.
"Let it come," Scar said quietly from the other side of the line. "They want us dead? Well, I'm not going to back down. We'll show them what courage is. They can hide behind our bridges while we charge." "That's no victory," Moash said. "I say we attack the soldiers, right now."
"Our own troops?" Sigzel said, turning his dark-skinned head and looking down the line of men.
"Sure," Moash said, eyes still forward. "They're going to kill us anyway. Let's take a few of them with us. Damnation, why not charge Sadius? His guard won't expect it. I'll bet we could knock down a few and grab their spears, then be on to killing Light Eyes before they cut us down."
A couple of bridgemen murmured their assent as the soldiers continued to cross.
"No," Kaladin said. "It won't accomplish anything. They'd have us dead before we so much as inconvenience Sadius."
Moash spat.
"And this will accomplish something? Damnation, Kaladin, I feel like I'm already dangling from the noose."
"I have a plan," Kaladin said. He waited for the objections. His other plans hadn't worked. No one offered a complaint.
"Well then," Moash said, "what is it?"
"You'll see today," Kaladin said. "If it works, it'll buy us time. If it fails, I'll be dead."
He turned to look down the line of faces.
"In that case, Teft has orders to lead you on an escape attempt tonight. You're not ready, but at least you'll have a chance."
That was far better than attacking Sadius as he crossed. Kaladin's men nodded, and Moash seemed content. As contrary as he'd been originally, he had grown equally loyal. He was hot-headed, but he was also the best with the spear. Sadius approached, riding his roan stallion, wearing his red shard plate, helm on but visor up. By chance, he crossed on Kaladin's bridge, though, as always, he had 20 to choose from. Sadius didn't give Bridge 4 so much as a glance.
"Break and cross," Kaladin ordered after Sadius was over.
The bridgemen crossed their bridge, and Kaladin gave the orders for them to pull it behind them, then lift. It felt heavier than it ever had before. The bridgemen broke into a trot, rounding the army column and hustling to reach the next chasm. In the distance behind, a second army, one in blue, was following them, crossing using some of Sadius's other bridge crews. It looked like Dalinar Kholin had given up his bulky mechanical bridges and was now using Sadius's own bridge crews to cross. So much for his honor and not sacrificing bridgemen lives.
In his pouch, Kaladin carried a large number of infused spheres, obtained from the money changers in exchange for a greater quantity of dun spheres. He hated taking that loss, but he needed the stormlight. They reached the next chasm quickly. It would be the next-to-last one, according to the word he'd gotten from Natal, Ashal's husband. The soldiers began checking their armor, stretching, and dissipation spren rising in the air like small streamers. The bridgemen set their bridge and stepped back. Kaladin noted Lopin and Silent Dabid approaching with their stretcher, water skins and bandages inside. Lopin had hitched the stretcher to a hook at his waist, making up for his missing arm. The two moved among the members of Bridge Four, giving them water. As he passed Kaladin, Lopin nodded toward the large bulge at the stretcher's center. The armor. "When do you want it?" Lopin asked softly, lowering the litter, then handing Kaladin a water skin. "Right before we run the assault," Kaladin replied. "You did well, Lopin." Lopin winked. "A one-armed Hardassian is still twice as useful as a no-brained Alethi. Plus, so long as I've got one hand, I can still do this." He covertly made a rude gesture toward the marching soldiers. Kaladin smiled, but was growing too nervous to feel mirth. It had been a long time since he'd gotten jitters going into a battle. He thought Tux had beaten that out of him years ago. "Hey," a sudden voice called. "I need some of that." Kaladin spun to see a soldier walking over. He was exactly the type of man Kaladin had known to avoid back in Amaram's army. Dark-eyed but of modest rank, he was naturally large, and had probably gotten promoted by sheer virtue of size. His armor was well-maintained, but the uniform beneath was stained and wrinkled, and he kept the sleeves rolled up, exposing hairy arms. At first, Kaladin assumed that the man had seen Lopin's gesture, but the man didn't seem mad. He shoved Kaladin aside, then pulled the water skin away from Lopin. Nearby, the soldiers waiting to cross had noticed. Their own water crews were much slower, and more than a few of the waiting men eyed Lopin and his water skins. It would set a terrible precedent to let the soldiers take their water, but that was only a tiny problem compared with the greater one. If those soldiers swarmed around the litter to get water, they'd discover the sack full of armor. Kaladin moved quickly, snatching the water skin from the soldier's hand. "You have your own water crews." The soldier looked at Kaladin, as if completely unable to believe that a bridgeman was standing up to him. He scowled darkly, lowering his spear to his side, its butt against the ground.
"I don't want to wait."
"How unfortunate," Kaladin said, stepping right up to the man, meeting him eye to eye. Silently he cursed the idiot. If it turned into a scuffle. The soldier hesitated, even more astonished to see such an aggressive threat from a bridgeman. Kaladin wasn't as thick-armed as this man, but he was a finger or two taller. The soldier's uncertainty showed in his face. "Just back down," Kaladin thought. But no, backing down from a bridgeman while his squad was watching? The man made a fist, knuckles cracking. Within seconds, the entire bridge crew was there. The soldier blinked as Bridge Four formed around Kaladin in an aggressive inverted wedge pattern, moving naturally, smoothly, as Kaladin had trained them. Each one made fists, giving the soldier ample chance to see that the heavy lifting had trained these men to a physical level beyond that of the average soldier. The man glanced back at his squad as if looking for support. "Do you want to spark a fight now, friend?" Kaladin asked softly. "If you hurt the bridgeman, I wonder who Sadius will make run this bridge." The man glanced back at Kaladin, was silent for a moment, then scowled, cursed, and stalked away.
"Probably full of crim anyway," he muttered, rejoining his team.
The members of Bridge Four relaxed, though they received more than a few appreciative looks from the other soldiers in line. For once, there was something other than scowls. Hopefully they wouldn't realize that a squad of bridgemen had quickly and accurately made a battle formation commonly used in spear fighting. Kaladin waved for his men to stand down, nodding his thanks.
They fell back, and Kaladin tossed the recovered waterskin back to Lopin. The shorter man smirked wryly.
I'll keep a tighter grip on these things from now on, Goncho.
He eyed the soldier who had tried to take the water. What? Kaladin asked.
Well, I've got a cousin in the water crews, you see, Lopin said, and I'm thinking that he might owe me a favor on account of this one time I helped his sister's friend escape a guy looking for her.
You do have a lot of cousins.
Never enough. You bother one of us, you bother us all. That's something you strawheads never seem to get. No offense or anything, Goncho.
Kaladin raised an eyebrow. Don't make trouble for the soldier. Not today. I'll make enough of that myself here soon. Lopin sighed, but nodded.
All right. For you.
He held up a waterskin.
You sure you don't want any?
Kaladin didn't. His stomach was too unsettled, but he made himself take the waterskin back and drink a few mouthfuls. Before long, the time came to cross and pull the bridge up for the last run. The assault. Sarius's soldiers were forming ranks, light eyes riding back and forth, calling orders. Matal waved Kaladin's crew forward. Dalinar Kolin's army had fallen behind, coming more slowly because of his larger numbers. Kaladin took his place at the very front of his bridge. Ahead, the Parshendi were lined up with bows on the edge of their plateau, staring down the oncoming assault. Were they singing already? Kaladin thought he could hear their voices. Moash was on Kaladin's right, Rock on his left. Only three on the death line because of how shorthanded they were. He'd put Shen in the very back so he wouldn't see what Kaladin was about to do.
I'm going to duck out from underneath once we start moving, Kaladin told them. Rock, you take over. Keep them running.
Very well, Rock said. It will be hard to carry without you. We have so few men, and we are very weak.
You'll manage. You'll have to.
Kaladin couldn't see Rock's face, not positioned under the bridge as they were, but his voice sounded troubled.
This thing you will try is dangerous?
Perhaps.
Can I help?
I'm afraid not, my friend. But it strengthens me to hear you ask.
Rock didn't get a chance to reply. Matal yelled for the bridge crews to go. Arrows shot overhead to distract the Parshendi. Bridge four broke into a run. And Kaladin ducked down and dashed out in front of them. Lopin was waiting to the side, and he tossed Kaladin the sack of armor. Matal screamed at Kaladin in a panic, but the bridge crews were already in motion. Kaladin focused on his goal, protecting Bridge Four, and sucked in sharply. Stormlight flooded him from the pouch at his waist, but he didn't draw too much, just enough to give him a jolt of energy. Syl zipped in front of him, a ripple in the air, nearly invisible. Kaladin whipped the tie off the sack, pulling out the vest and throwing it awkwardly over his head. He ignored the ties at the side, getting on the helm as he leaped over a small rock formation. The shield came last, clattering with red Parshendi bones in a crisscross pattern on the front. Even while donning the armor, Kaladin easily stayed far ahead of the heavily laden bridge crews. His stormlight-infused legs were quick and sure. The Parshendi archers, directly ahead of him, abruptly stopped singing. Several of them lowered their bows, and though it was too distant to make out their faces, he could sense their outrage. Kaladin had expected this. He'd hoped for it. The Parshendi left their dead. Not because they were uncaring, but because they found it a terrible offense to move them. Merely touching the dead seemed a sin. If that was the case, a man desecrating corpses and wearing them into battle would be far, far worse. As Kaladin grew closer, a different song started among the Parshendi archers. A quick, violent song, more chant than melody. Those who had lowered their bows raised them, and they tried with everything they had to kill him. Arrows flew at him, dozens of them. They weren't fired in careful waves, they flew individually, rapidly, wildly, each archer loosing at Kaladin as quickly as he could. A swarm of death bore down on him. Pulse racing, Kaladin ducked to the left, leaping off a small outcropping. Arrows sliced the air around him, dangerously close.
but while infused with the stormlight, his muscles reacted quickly. He dodged between arrows, then turned in the other direction, moving erratically. Behind, Bridge 4 came into range, and not a single arrow was fired at them. Other bridge crews were ignored as well, many of the archers focusing on Kaladin. The arrows came more swiftly, spraying around him, bouncing off his shield. One sliced open his arm as it shot past. Another snapped against his helm, nearly knocking it free. The arm wound leaked light, not blood, and to Kaladin's amazement it slowly began to seal up, frost crystallizing on his skin and stormlight draining from him. He drew in more, infusing himself to the cusp of glowing visibility. He ducked, he dodged, he jumped, he ran. His battle-trained reflexes delighted in the newfound speed, and he used the shield to knock arrows out of the air. It was as if his body had longed for this ability, as if it had been born to take advantage of the stormlight. During the earlier part of his life, he had lived sluggish and impotent. Now he was healed, not acting beyond his capacities, no, finally reaching them. A flock of arrows sought his blood, but Kaladin spun between them, taking another slice on the arm but deflecting the others with shield or breastplate. The flight came, and he brought his shield up, worried that he was going to be too slow. However, the arrows changed course, arcing toward his shield, slamming into it, drawn to it. "I'm pulling them to it." He remembered dozens of bridge runs with arrows slamming into the wood near where his hands had clung to the support bars, always just missing him. "How long have I been doing this?" Kaladin thought. "How many arrows did I draw to the bridge, pulling them away from me?" He didn't have time to think about that. He kept moving, dodging. He felt arrows whish through the air, heard them zip, felt the splinters as they hit stone or shield and broke. He'd hoped that he would distract some of the Parshendi from firing on his men, but he'd had no idea how strong a reaction he'd get. Part of him exulted in the thrill of ducking, dodging, and blocking the hail of arrows. He started to slow, however. He tried to suck in stormlight, but none came. His spheres were drained. He panicked, still dodging, but then the arrow falls began to slacken. With a start, Kaladin realized that the bridge crews had parted around him, leaving a space for him to keep dodging while they passed him and set their burdens. Bridge 4 was in place, cavalry charging across to attack the archers. Despite that, some of the Parshendi continued to fire on Kaladin, enraged. The soldiers cut these Parshendi down easily, sweeping the ground of them and making room for Satius's foot soldiers. Kaladin lowered his shield. It bristled with arrows. He barely had time to take a fresh breath of air as the bridgemen reached him, calling out with joy, nearly tackling him in their excitement.
"You fool," Moash said. "You storming fool! What was that? What were you thinking?"
"Was incredible," Rock said.
"You should be dead," Sigzel said, though his normally stern face was split by a smile.
"Stormfather," Moash added, pulling an arrow from Kaladin's vest at the shoulder. "Look at these."
Kaladin looked down, shocked to find a dozen arrow holes in the sides of his vest and shirt where he'd narrowly avoided being hit. Three arrows stuck from the leather.
"Storm blessed," Scar said. "That's all there is to it."
Kaladin shrugged off their praise, his heart still pounding. He was numb. Amazed that he'd survived, cold from the stormlight he'd consumed, exhausted as if he'd run a rigorous obstacle course. He looked to Teft, raising an eyebrow, nodding toward the pouch at his waist. Teft shook his head. He'd watched. The stormlight rising from Kaladin hadn't been visible to those observing, not in the light of day. Still, the way Kaladin had dodged would have looked incredible, even without the obvious light. If there had been stories about him before, they would grow greatly following this. He turned to look at the passing troops. As he did, he realized something. He still had to deal with Metal.
"Fall into line, men," he said.
They obeyed reluctantly, falling into place around him in a double rank. Ahead, Metal stood beside their bridge. He looked concerned, as well he should. Satius was riding up. Kaladin steeled himself, remembering how his previous victory, when they'd run with the bridge on its side, had been turned on its head.
He hesitated, then hurried over toward the bridge where Sadeus was going to ride past Matal. Kaladin's men followed. Kaladin arrived as Matal bowed to Sadeus, who wore his glorious red shard plate. Kaladin and the bridgemen bowed as well.
"Avarak Matal," Sadeus said.
He nodded toward Kaladin.
"This man looks familiar."
"He is the one from before, Bright Lord," Matal said, nervous.
"The one who..."
"Ah, yes," Sadeus said.
"The miracle. And you sent him forward as a decoy like that? One would think that you would be hesitant to dare such measures."
"I take full responsibility, Bright Lord," Matal said, putting the best face on it.
Sadeus regarded the battlefield.
"Well, luckily for you, it worked. I suppose I'll have to promote you now."
He shook his head.
"Those savages practically ignored the assault force. All 20 bridges set, most with nary a casualty. It seems like a waste somehow. Consider yourself commended. Most remarkable the way that boy dodged."
He kicked his horse into motion, leaving Matal and the bridgeman behind. It was the most backhanded promotion Kaladin had ever heard, but that would do. Kaladin smiled broadly as Matal turned to him, eyes enraged.
"You!"
Matal sputtered.
"You could have gotten me executed!"
"Instead I got you promoted," Kaladin said, bridge four forming around him.
"I should see you strung up anyway."
"It's been tried," Kaladin said. "Didn't work. Besides, you know that from now on Sadeus is going to expect me to be out there distracting the archers. Good luck getting any other bridgeman to try that." Matal's face grew red. He turned and stalked away to check on the other bridge crews. The two nearest, Bridge 7 and Bridge 18, stood looking toward Kaladin and his team. All 20 bridges had been set? Hardly any casualties? "Stormfather," Kaladin thought. "How many archers were firing at me?"
"You did it, Kaladin,"
Moash exclaimed. "You found the secret. We need to make this work. Expand it."
"I'll bet I could dodge those arrows if that were all I was doing," Scar said. "With enough armor."
"We should have more than one," Moash agreed. 5 or so running around drawing the Parshendi attacks."
"The bones," Rock said, folding his arms. "This is what made it work. The Parshendi were so mad that they ignored bridge crew. If all 5 were the bones of Parshendi..."
That made Kaladin consider something. He looked back, searching through the bridgemen. Where was Shen? There. He was sitting on the rocks, distant, staring forward. Kaladin approached with the others. The Parshman looked up at him, face a mask of pain, tears streaking his cheeks. He looked at Kaladin and shuddered visibly, turning away, closing his eyes.
"He sat down like that the moment he saw what you'd done, lad," Teft said, rubbing his chin. "Might not be good for bridge runs anymore."
Kaladin pulled the carapace-tied helm off his head, then ran his fingers through his hair. The carapace stuck to his clothing, stank faintly, even though he'd washed it off down below.
"We'll see,"
Kaladin said, feeling a twist of guilt. Not nearly enough to overshadow the victory of protecting his men, but enough to dampen it, at least. "For now, there are still many bridge crews that got fired upon. You know what to do." The men nodded, trotting off to search for the wounded. Kaladin set one man to watch over Shen, he wasn't sure what else to do with the Parshman, and tried not to show his exhaustion as he put his sweaty, carapace-covered cap and vest in Lopin's litter. He knelt down to go through his medical equipment, in case it was needed, and found that his hand was shaking and quivering. He pressed it down against the ground to still it, breathing in and out. "Cold, clammy skin," he thought. "Nausea? Weakness?" He was in shock.
"You all right, lad?"
Teft asked, kneeling down beside Kaladin. He still wore a bandage on his arm from the wound he'd taken a few bridge runs back, but it wasn't enough to stop him from carrying. Not when there were too few as it was.
"I'll be fine," Kaladin said, taking out a water skin,
holding it in a quivering hand. He could barely get the top off.
You don't look.
I'll be fine, Kaladin said again, drinking, then lowering the water. What's important is that the men are safe.
You going to do this every time? Whenever we go to battle?
Whatever keeps them safe.
You're not immortal, Kaladin, Teft said softly. The Radiance, they could be killed just like any man. Sooner or later, one of those arrows will find your neck instead of your shoulder.
The Stormlight heals.
The Stormlight helps your body heal. That's different, I'm thinking.
Teft laid a hand on Kaladin's shoulder.
We can't lose you, lad. The men need you.
I'm not going to avoid putting myself in danger, Teft, and I'm not going to leave the men to face a storm of arrows if I can do something about it.
Well, Teft said, you are going to let a few of us go out there with you. The bridge can manage with 25 if it has to. That leaves us a few extra, just like Rock said. And I'll bet some of those wounded from the other crews we saved are well enough to begin helping carry. They won't dare send them back to their own crews, not so long as Bridge 4 is doing what you did today, and helping the whole assault work.
Kaladin trailed off. He could imagine Dalet doing something like this. He'd always said that as a sergeant, part of his job was to keep Kaladin alive.
All right.
Teft nodded, rising.
You were a spearman, Teft, Kaladin said. Don't try to deny it.
How did you end up here, in these bridge crews?
It's where I belong.
Teft turned away to supervise the search for wounded. Kaladin sat down, then lay back, waiting for the shock to wear off. To the south, the other army, flying the blue of Dalinar Kholin, had arrived. They crossed to an adjacent plateau. Kaladin closed his eyes to recover. Eventually, he heard something and opened his eyes. Syl sat cross-legged on his chest. Behind her, Dalinar Kholin's army had begun an assault onto the battlefield, and they managed to do so without getting fired on. Sadeas had the Parshendi cut off.
That was amazing, Kaladin said to Syl. What I did with the arrows.
Still think you're cursed?
No. I know I'm not.
He looked up at the overcast sky. But that means the failures were all just me. I let Tien die. I failed my spearmen. The slaves I tried to rescue. Terra. He hadn't thought of her in some time. His failure with her had been different from the others, but a failure it was, nonetheless.
If there's no curse or bad luck, no god above being angry at me, I have to live with knowing that with a little more effort, a little more practice or skill, I could have saved them.
Syl frowned more deeply.
Kaladin, you need to get over this. Those things aren't your fault.
That's what my father used to say.
He smiled faintly.
Overcome your guilt, Kaladin. Care, but not too much. Take responsibility, but don't blame yourself. Protect, save, help, but know when to give up. They're such precarious ledges to walk. How do I do it?
I don't know. I don't know any of this, Kaladin. But you're ripping yourself apart. Inside and out.
Kaladin stared at the sky above.
It was wondrous. I was a storm, Syl. The Parshendi couldn't touch me. The arrows were nothing.
You're too new to this. You pushed yourself too hard.
Save them, Kaladin whispered. Do the impossible, Kaladin. But don't push yourself too hard. But also don't feel guilty if you fail. Precarious ledges, Syl. So narrow.
Some of his men returned with a wounded man, a square-faced Thalen fellow with an arrow in the shoulder. Kaladin went to work. His hands were still shaking slightly, but not nearly as badly as they had been. The bridgemen clustered around, watching. He'd started training Rock, Drahi, and Scar already, but with all of them watching, Kaladin found himself explaining.
If you put pressure here, you can slow the blood flow. This isn't too dangerous a wound, though it probably doesn't feel too good. The patient grimaced his agreement. And the real problem will come from infection. Wash the wound to make sure there aren't any slivers of wood or bits of metal left, then sew it. The muscles and skin of the shoulder here are going to get worked, so you need a strong thread to hold the wound together. Now...
Kaladin,
Lopin said, sounding worried. What? Kaladin said, distracted, still working.
Kaladin!
Lopin had called him by his name, rather than saying Goncho. Kaladin stood up, turning to see the short-haired Asian man standing at the back of the crowd, pointing at the chasm. The battle had moved farther north, but a group of Parshendi had punched through Sadius's line. They had bows. Kaladin watched, stunned, as the group of Parshendi fell into formation and knocked. 50 arrows, all pointed at Kaladin's crew. The Parshendi didn't seem to care that they were exposing themselves to attack from behind. They seemed focused on only one thing, destroying Kaladin and his men. Kaladin screamed the alarm, but he felt so sluggish, so tired. The bridgemen around him turned as the archers drew. Sadius's men normally defended the chasm to keep Parshendi from pushing over the bridges and cutting off their escape. But this time, noticing that the archers weren't trying to drop the bridges, the soldiers didn't hasten to stop them. They left the bridgemen to die, instead cutting off the Parshendi route to the bridges themselves. Kaladin's men were exposed. Perfect targets. No, Kaladin thought.
No! It can't happen like this. Not after...
A force crashed into the Parshendi line. A single figure in slate-gray armor wielding a sword as long as many men were tall. The shard-bearer swept through the distracted archers with urgency, slicing into their ranks. Arrows flew toward Kaladin's team, but they were loosed too early, aimed poorly. A few came close as the bridgemen ducked for cover, but nobody was hit. Parshendi fell before the sweeping blade of the shard-bearer, some toppling into the chasm, others scrambling back. The rest died with burned-out eyes. In seconds, the squad of 50 archers had been reduced to corpses. The shard-bearer's honor guard caught up with him. He turned, armor seeming to glow as he raised his blade in a salute of respect toward the bridgemen. Then he charged off in another direction.
That was him, Dre said, standing up. Dalinar Kolin, the king's uncle.
He saved us, Lopin said.
Bah! Moash dusted himself off. He just saw a group of undefended archers and took the chance to strike. Light Eyes don't care about us. Right, Kaladin?
Kaladin stared at the place where the archers had stood. In one moment, he could have lost it all.
Kaladin? Moash said.
You're right, Kaladin found himself saying. Just an opportunity taken. Except why raise the blade toward Kaladin?
From now on, Kaladin said, we pull back farther after the soldiers cross. They used to ignore us after the battle began, but they won't any longer. What I did today, what we're all going to be doing soon, will make them mighty angry. Angry enough to be stupid, but also angry enough to see us dead. For now, Leighton, Narm, find good scouting points and watch the field. I want to know if any Parshendi make moves toward that chasm. I'll get this man bandaged, and we'll pull back.
The two scouts ran off, and Kaladin turned back to the man with the wounded shoulder. Moash knelt beside him.
An assault against a prepared for without any bridges lost? A shard-bearer coincidentally coming to our rescue? Sadius himself complimenting us? You almost make me think I should get one of those armbands.
Kaladin glanced down at the prayer. It was stained with blood from a slice on his arm that the vanishing stormlight hadn't quite been able to heal.
Wait to see if we escape, Kaladin finished the stitching. That's the real test.
Fear. I wish to sleep. I know now why you do what you do, and I hate you for it. I will not speak of the truths I see.
Kakasha, 1173.
142 seconds pre-death. A Shin sailor, left behind by his crew, reportedly for bringing them ill luck. Sample largely useless.
You see?
Layton turned the piece of carapace over in his hands.
If we carve it up at the edge, it encourages a blade, or in this case an arrow, to deflect away from the face. Wouldn't want to spoil that pretty grin of yours.
Kaladin smiled, taking back the piece of armor. Layton had carved it expertly, putting in holes for leather straps to affix it to the jerkin. The chasm was cold and dark at night. With the sky hidden, it felt like a cavern. Only the occasional sparkle of a star high above revealed otherwise. How soon can you have them done? He asked Layton.
All five? By the end of the night, likely? The real trick was discovering how to work it.
He knocked on the carapace with the back of his knuckles.
Amazing stuff. Nearly as hard as steel, but half the weight. Hard to cut or break. But if you drill, it shapes easily.
Good, Kaladin said. Because I don't want five sets. I want one for each man in the crew. Layton raised an eyebrow. If they're going to start letting us wear armor, Kaladin said, everyone gets a suit. Except Shen, of course. Metall had agreed to let them leave him behind on the bridge runs. He wouldn't even look at Kaladin now. Layton nodded.
All right, then. Better get me some help, though.
You can use the wounded men. We'll cart out as much carapace as we can find. His success had translated to an easier time for Bridge 4. Kaladin had pled that his men needed time to find carapace, and Hashal, not knowing any better, had reduced the scavenging quota. She was already pretending, quite smoothly, that the armor had been her idea the entire time. When she met Kaladin's eyes, however, he saw worry. What else would he try? So far, she hadn't dared remove him. Not while he brought her so much praise from Sadeus.